Welcome, everyone, to another edition of ACE's Patient Focused Update, the podcast for Americans for Safe Access. Learn more at safeaccessnow.org. I'm Russ Belville, and joining us is ACE's Chief Science Officer, Dr. Jehan Marcu. Jehan, welcome back.
Hello. Thank you, Russ.
You know, we are so excited to be able to talk about the developments in medical cannabis. Just last week, we had New York's Governor Mario Cuomo signing a bill that added post-traumatic stress to the list of qualifying conditions. Is that something that's happening pretty much around the medical cannabis states now, or are there still a few that don't recognize that?
It is happening fairly consistently. We're still running into issues where states don't want to have a cannabis program, and they're sending their patients, you know, the parents of sick children have to travel to other states to get those products. So I think this is actually, as from the 10,000 foot view of the U.S., most states are moving towards expanding conditions or getting rid of condition lists altogether. Delaware only covers symptoms, not specific conditions. Washington, D.C. has gotten rid of a condition list. And they're trying this approach that's worked with medicine in the past, where Congress and elected officials don't determine what's a medicine and what its appropriate use is, but the physician and the healthcare providers and the patients and caregivers are involved in that discussion. And so I think that's the general way that the nation will be going with medical cannabis, is condition lists were a place to start, but I think the information about cannabis is, there's so much of it out there about the therapeutic properties and the risks, that I think that those condition lists are going to be something that the next generation of people coming in the industry are just going to hear about as being myths or legends, hopefully.
We hope so. Doesn't it seem strange to have to think of doctors being in charge of the medical practice as something revolutionary? It seems to me that should be the standard, but let's talk a little bit about the patient-focused certification, because this has been a big development for Americans for Safe Access, because there's somewhat of a dearth of understanding when it comes to what's legit and what's not legit. So tell our listeners a little bit about it and any updates you can give us for the upcoming months.
So ACE's patient-focused certification program has continued its busy schedule of trainings and outreach. And since the last recording of this podcast, you know, we have we've been in Nashville, Tennessee, working with advocates and presenting, actually requested our testimony in front of the state task force on medical cannabis. And the officials there said they're going to look for how to use PFC to help create health and safety regulations and help implement those in their program. So we're going to be back in early 2018 to train regulators, to train stakeholders and patients, a part of a tour that will also include Arkansas and Louisiana. And, you know, and following that, at the end of October, in November 6th, 7th, we had a very successful training in Maryland where we trained dispensary staff as well as what we call verified professionals or managers. And this provides people a chance to get in-depth training on quality control, quality assurance, integrative pest management, not just being able to think through problems and things like that, and understand how a system works to produce high-quality products and keep the workers safe as well as the public. But in the midst of all that, we also had a co-authored article come out in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled "Labeling Accuracy of Cannabidiol Extracts Sold Online." And this report was done in collaboration with many other researchers. The lead author was Marcel Bon Miller from UPenn. We also include Brian Thomas from Research Triangle Institute, as well as Ryan Vandry, who is at Johns Hopkins currently doing inhaled cannabis studies. And we worked on this report, and they reached out to ASA or PFC because they wanted to identify labs that were properly both accredited and certified to do the results. So they knew that if they sent the lab, whatever form the product was in, that the lab had these methods to prepare the sample for analysis, as well as the methods to analyze it properly and all those little things. And so We're pretty surprised a little bit at the results. And if you haven't heard about this study yet, 84 products were purchased online, and 70% of them were more than 10% off in the label values, about 30% under, 30% over. And, you know, these were all, again, purchased online, which probably means that whoever was selling them online was not part of a state regulated program. And so before people go into their, you know, into Maryland or Colorado or any other state that has a regulated program with oversight and inspections and throwing out their CBD products, you have to remember that the first thing is that these people are already in violation of the Cole memo. And so they're probably might not be following other standards. There's no way of really knowing that, but still some of the products were accurate as well. So, you know, I think what this points to is it's a wake-up call for the industry, and part of this research has been just telling, you know, that the industry needs to further work standardizing the product. Some of them are getting it right and some of them are getting it wrong. And I think that in order to move cannabis products forward, we have to, you know, adopt more quality control, quality assurance procedures, and really tackle this thing seriously. Because I'd like the next round, because this is the third or fourth study of its type to be published. The previous one was done with THC and CBD products. There's two of these studies going on in Europe right now. And what I'd love to see is in a year or two when they do this secret shopping and testing study again is that, you know, less than 5% of the products fall outside of an acceptable range of variants or are standardized. You know, and I think that moving forward, we're going to see a lot more companies striving harder to meet this. And again, this came off the tailwind, for better or for worse, right after the FDA sent a lot of letters out to companies for violating basic, you know, claims about their products. So I think this is a great opportunity for businesses to demonstrate that they're not only following the regs, but they're going above and beyond what is expected of them in this environment.
Yes, I'm glad that that information is getting out there, and it shows once again how legalization, regulation, having standards are so important in medicine and what we're doing today. I'd also like to talk to you, Dr. Marcoux, about opioids. There's recently a lawmaker in Illinois who proposed a law that said anyone that was battling opioids could get a temporary medical marijuana card immediately. It's kind of an innovative strategy that would be somewhat based on what we've learned, is that access to medical cannabis reduces problems with opioids. But meanwhile, the president's Blue Ribbon Commission on the Opioid Crisis has pointedly ignored the ability of cannabis to help and, in fact, made claims against it, saying it would be worse, invoking some gateway theory even. Give us your reaction to this Opioid Commission and tell us what Americans for Safe Access is doing in response.
Well, you know, we're talking about standards for cannabis products, and the same thing applies when it comes to information from government, right? We have this thing called the Information Quality Act, previously known as the Data Quality Act, which allows us to challenge information on government websites that's inaccurate. Now, ASA sued the DEA last year because there were 23 violations in a single document that the DEA was handing out to, you know, elementary and high school teachers, to researchers, about the dangers and risks of cannabis, which were based largely on outdated research and their own press releases. And we said, look, this is the information they're using to create, basically to create policy and influence policy. And that document is no longer on the site. So we know that FOIAs and doing this way are effective, but you know that, you know, the issue you mentioned with getting a cannabis card to be able to reduce the use of opiates is important. You know, pain is probably one of the most significant public health problems in the U.S. It counts for at least $635 billion annually, which means it breaks down to about $2,000 per person in the U.S., right? That's what the public health costs come out to, which is kind of staggering. And so when we see the ignoring of research by the Trump Opioid Commission, it presented grossly misleading information. And, you know, our director, Steph Scheer, has gone on the record saying that, quote, the timing of the only study they cite is suspect, as they did not use the best available science about medical cannabis. The practice of ignoring important clinical research mirrors the data that was ignored in the 90s and early 2000s on cannabis and chronic pain when opioid prescribing multiplied across healthcare settings and led to the current epidemic of abuse, misuse, and addiction. Now, a lot of people talk about this report that talks about a 2.5 or 2 something increase in opioid use disorder. But even the author, when he was interviewed, Olfson, after the Opioid Commission's report, he even came out and said they left out all the important information from our report. They left out the part that said that the great majority, the significant part of his study, funded by NIDA, was that the great majority of people who use cannabis do not go on to develop an opioid use disorder. There is always a vulnerable population that we have to be aware of and vigilant for. But for the great majority of the population that is dealing with chronic pain, anecdotally, with some clinical research, with epidemiological research, it's all showing that there are potential benefits. And I think that that is really difficult to ignore, especially since the commission was formed just months after the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine released the health effects of cannabis and cannabinoids, the current state of evidence and recommendations for research. Now, this was that big 10,000 studied, you know, that they reviewed, and they put out this book, which was an update to the late 1990s IOM report. And the report found, quote, in adults with chronic pain, patients who were treated with cannabis or cannabinoids are more likely to experience a clinically significant reduction in pain symptoms. End quote. There is substantial evidence that cannabis is an effective treatment for chronic pain in adults. And the commission, you know, what Christy wrote about the 2.5 times greater chance about opioid use disorder is actually not supported by the research that they presented. Their report is also was also co-authored by Bertha Madras, who has recently been removed from UN commissions on drug research. She hasn't been, rarely as will anyone else publish international reports with her, because she is a fiercely anti-cannabis, and so we found out that political people like her were involved. We wanted to know what other researchers have they reached out to. And so part of the FOIA request was to disclose documents and communications. They said they talked to researchers. Really? Who did they talk to? We want to see those emails. Was it just one political figurehead of the anti-medical cannabis agenda? Or was it pros and cons, different people, which were or was it just one research report that they cherry-picked? And so the FOIA by Americans for Safe Access requests any communications about medical cannabis, as well as information or communications that led to the drafting, development, or decision-making process that appeared in the November 1st letter from the President's Commission on Drug Abuse and Opioid Crisis. And what's exciting is that the NIH and ONDCP have 20 federal business days to deliver or ask for an extension or deny this request. And so I think that it would be very in poor taste for them to deny such a simple request, which is, what information did you actually use to come about this? And the claims you're making, what were they supported by? And I think that that's, as the public, we have a right to know whether or not the billions of dollars that we're giving for research in this country, whether or not they're actually looking at any of that, of the taxpayers' research that they've been funding through the NIH and NIDA. Think of all those studies over the decades, almost 100 some odd clinical trials with cannabis and cannabis products. Did they look at any of those? Did they look at the dozens of clinical pain studies? Did they even look at one that was published a few years ago on inhaled cannabis to treat diabetic neuropathy? So we'd like to know that what they looked at. So I think in the future, we're going to find out really quickly by the end of the month, maybe in time for Thanksgiving, whether or not they will tell us what information they used to reach this opinion. Because even the author of the report, the one report they cite, does not agree with them, which is interesting. And even in the report they cite, it says, quote unquote, interpret our results with caution and even hint that they should not be used to make broad policy decisions. So one, it shows me that they probably didn't read anything beyond the headline of the study, but there's a lot more there. So, you know, in short, the opioid crisis draft lacks any mention of the available and sophisticated clinical research data on the safety of cannabis to treat chronic pain. The information it presents is largely focused on a single study that was released months ahead of schedule, which was survey data. They didn't even confirm that these people were actually cannabis users in the study. It was, you know, maybe they were paying people and asking them, hey, if you participate in the study, tell us how much cannabis you use. And, you know, they say surveys are only as strong as their methods. And if you run a survey, it can be a great sort of initial check, on weather conditions, as it were, in public health. But it really doesn't provide any clinical significance to do surveys that don't actually confirm that these people were using any of these substances. And that's one of the things you always have to remember about a lot of these surveys is it's just people online filling out a survey. They aren't actually meeting these people, confirming in any way that they've used these products, other than asking them, have you ever used marijuana? They say yes, you know, and it's it can be as broad as that. So again, surveys are great because they're inexpensive and you can try to reproduce them quite inexpensively and quickly. But we should be really cautious of taking any single survey as gospel or as fact. You know, an extremely large amount of work, effort, and information goes into proving even the most trivial facts.
Well put. All right, final bit of information to get out on this edition would be the status of the amendment that's currently protecting the medical cannabis states. This was a can that was kicked down the road back in September. The amendment forbids the Department of Justice from spending any money, taxpayer money, to go after the medical cannabis states. I understand it's up for renewal soon. What is the prognosis?
The prognosis is we don't know. It's surprisingly, I believe, on that date or around that date, you know, is also the deadline for Maryland to be up and running as a medical cannabis program. It's sort of the final licensing announcement for the different phases of licensing they have there. And so, you know, we've been preparing to either let everyone know that they are no longer protected the day after they're up and running in on the East Coast and elsewhere, or that they're that the state laws will be respected. So, you know, ACE has been trying to put a ton of resources into making sure that this amendment does pass with the budget, because it has to be voted on every year. And who knows? I mean, maybe we'll see it passed again along with the budget. We'll see. It's an unfortunate kind of, it's going to be close, I think. But, you know, we have had good luck with the previous administration. We had some good luck last year. But right now, I think it takes pressure on Congress, pressure on your elected officials, and really supporting medical cannabis advocacy, because that is what is making the difference right now on this level. Will they protect patients? Will they protect the caregivers and the intrepid businessmen who provide them with quality products? And so I really, is my hope and belief that we need this to pass in order to keep the DEA from interfering with legal programs. So if you haven't written an elected official about it, you haven't done your part, you should really do that. And there's no shortage of things you can do. You know, either help us tackle the opioid crisis, write your elected officials about the CJS amendment to defund the DEA's activity, the Department of Justice activity against legally operating businesses, and the patients as well. So, if you're not doing something and you're not a little scared, you're not paying attention.
Absolutely. Check out safeaccessnow.org, the website for Americans for Safe Access, where you can find more information on the amendment and how you can get involved. Dr. Jehan Marku is the Chief Science Officer for Americans for Safe Access, and we'll talk to you again soon on another edition of the Patient Focus Update. Thanks, Jehan.
Thank you.